head. So, but it is really Emily Dickinson who is being honored by all of these lions sitting in this circle. So I will stop worrying about myself and think about her. I want to begin by saying that Emily Dickinson was an artist, I would say an artist of metamorphosis, who located herself quite consciously in a female world of myth and magic, of empowered domesticity, of powerful difference, and of poetic self-dramatization. And I'll just tell you two stories about her, or read two comments about her, that seem to me to explain just how mythical and how magical she made herself. The first little story that I want to read you, in case you haven't already heard it in the last day and a half, is by a little comment that was made in a letter by Mabel Todd, who's later to become one of Dickinson's editors. It's a very famous comment, actually, and one that was often misinterpreted by people, but that I think is crucial in understanding Dickinson. I must tell you about the character of Amherst, says Mabel Loomis Todd. She's just arrived in Amherst, Massachusetts, where her husband is the director of the observatory. It is a lady whom the people call the myth. She is a sister of Mr. Dickinson and seems to be the climax of all the family oddity. She has not been outside of her own house in 15 years, except once to see a new church when she crept out at night and viewed it by moonlight. No one who calls upon her mother and sister ever sees, but she allows little children once in a great while and one at a time to come in when she gives them cake or candy or some nice thing, for she is very fond of little ones. But more often she lets down the sweet by a string out of a window. She dresses wholly in white, and her mind is said to be perfectly wonderful. She writes finely, but no one ever sees. Her sister, who was at Mrs. Dickinson's party, invited me to come and sing to her mother sometime. People tell me the myth will hear every note. She will be near, but unseen. Isn't that likeable? So interesting. Well, there's some way in which Dickinson is making herself likeable. The story has often been used against her to suggest how she's just this charming recluse, this peculiar sort of poetry writing homebody. But in fact, this is one of the ways in which she transformed herself into a myth and into an acolyte of a kind of female magic. The other story that I want to tell you is one that comes from a letter, written by her cousin, Clara Newman Turner. She says that the poet's little nephew, Ned, boy-like, had a way of leaving anything superfluous to his immediate needs at grandma. After one of these little sins of omission, overcame his high-top rubber boot, standing erect and spotless on a silver tray, the tops running over with emerald flowers. At another time, the little overcoat was returned with each velvet pocket pinned down and a card with "come in" on one and "knock" on the other. The "come in" proved to be raisins, the "knock" cracked nuts. Well, there's some way in which what we're dealing with here is a poet who transformed the ordinary into the extraordinary, the what would seem to be the daily, the domestic, into the miraculous and the magical. And I want to read tonight, in tribute to Dickinson, four poems of Dickinson's, which seem to me to emphasize her concern with difference, her yearning for a different world that would be mythical and magical, her concern with the problem of writing poetry as a woman, the issue of what kind of muse a woman poet has, and if a woman poet has a muse, what is it, sex? And finally, her conscious relationship to the female literary tradition. So I'm going to read four poems of hers, and then, alas, I'm going to read four poems of my own, although that feels like an absolute desecration to me to be reading poetry of mine in the same session in which I read poetry of hers, but at least I can claim that my poems, consciously or unconsciously written, in some way in response to themes and ideas that I found in her poetry and were an effort to pay tribute to her magic and her mythology. So the first poem of hers that I'm going to read is an early, I'll read these poems pretty much in chronological order. One is going to be slightly out of. The first one that I want to read is an early poem, which is about, as I said, her yearning for a different world, a world in which female difference could be liberated and celebrated. This is a poem, well, with Dickens, you have the problem with the titles. It's like the joke convention. This is going to be poem number 24, a name to conjure with, right? We call them by their first lines. This poem I call, "There Is a My Men Unseen." There is a morn by men unseen, whose maids upon remoter green keep their seraphic May, and all day long dance and game, and gamble I may never name, employ their holiday. Here to light measure move feet which walk no more the village street, nor by the wood are found. Here are the birds that sought sun when last year's distaff idle hung, and summer's brows were bound. Ne'er saw I such a wondrous scene, ne'er such a ring on such a green, nor so serene array, as if the stars some summer night should swing their cups chrysolite and revel till the day. Like thee to dance, like thee to sing, people upon the mystic green, I ask each new May morn, I wait thy far fantastic bells, announcing me in other dells unto the different dawn. I think it's important that that different dawn in some way is continuous with the world that Dickinson is reinventing when she puts raisins in one pocket and cracked nuts in another and says knock and come in and transforms the ordinary into the extraordinary. The next poem of hers that I want to read is, to go on giving you the numbers, in case you're taking notes, number 50. No, I'm sorry, it's not number 50, it's on page 50, it's number 103, further along in her career. And it is about the issue of a kind of muse. She doesn't specifically say that she's writing about a muse, but I think when you listen to the poem, you'll see that she really is. And here, she imagines muse as a silent, in some way sort of censorious male figure. I have a king who does not speak. So, wandering through the hours meek, I trudge the day away, half glad when it is night and sleep, if haply through a dream to peep in parlors shut by day. And if I do, when morning comes, it is as if 100 drums did round my pillow roll, and shouts fill my childish sky, and bells keep saying victory from steeples in my soul. And if I don't, the little bird within the orchard is not heard, and I omit pray, Father, thy will be done today, for my will goes the other way, and it will perjure me. Very interesting that you see here that there's a kind of agonistic struggle that she imagines between herself and the male muse. There are other poems where that becomes clearer, but I think this is interesting because he both cooperates sometimes and then other times just refuses to cooperate. On the other hand, for Dickinson, there are countless female figures, female deities, I would say, who really do cooperate. And one of my favorite poems, Dickinson, is about a kind of generalized range of female muses. This poem is number 722. Sweet mountain, ye tell me no lie. Never deny me, never fly. Those same unvarying eyes turn on me when I fail fame or take the royal names in vain, their far, slow, violet gaze. My strong Madonnas cherish still the wayward nun beneath the hill whose service is to you. Her latest worship when the day fades from the firmament away to lift her brows on you. I think it's interesting that this is a kind of prayer in a female theology, a female mythology, which she does feel empowers. It's very crucial. But then the last poem of hers that I want to read is one in which she very, very specifically locates herself in a female literary tradition. And you'll notice that in this poem, the female literary tradition that she locates herself in is one that she associates with magic, with witchcraft, with madness, with a kind of divine madness, and with transformation, with what I said seems to me to be central to her work, to her life, and that is metamorphosis. Because throughout them, everything metamorphoses into everything else, and everything becomes increasingly fantastic. The poem is about reading the poetry of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who is defined as that foreign lady, literally because she is foreign, she is an English woman, but figuratively speaking, because she's foreign to the culture, too, as a woman poet, and she becomes a kind of emblem of female poetic power who gives Dickinson permission to write, in a sense, and gives Dickinson the strength and the energy to transform her own world. I think I was enchanted when first a somber girl, I read that foreign lady. The dark felt beautiful, and whether it was noon at night or only heaven at night, for very lunacy of life, I had not power to tell. The bees became as butterflies. The butterflies, as swans, approached and spurned the narrow grass, and just the meanest tune that nature murmured self to keep herself in cheer, I took for giant, practicing titanic opera. The days to mighty meter step, the homeliest adorned, as if unto a jubilee, 'twere sudden firmed. I could not have defined the change. Conversion of mind, like sanctifying in the soul, is witnessed, not explained. 'Twas a divine insanity, the danger to be sane, should I again experience, 'tis antidote to turn to tomes of solid witchcraft. Magicians be asleep, but magic hath an element like deity to keep. Well, the transition from Dickinson's poem to my own is very painful for me. I can't think exactly what to do except say that I think I was and am enchanted when I read the poetry of Emily Dickinson, and I suppose it's out of a desire to express and explain my own enchantment that I did entitle my latest volume, Emily Bread. I'll explain that later on, although I bet that a lot of you know that she was a famous bread baker, as was Emily Bronte. Cooking and poetry seem to go together in some interesting ways. The poems of my own that I've chosen to read are poems that do try to respond to the themes that I've tried to locate in the Dickinson poems. The first two that I'll read to you are about the question of a female muse. As I said, feminist critics and women poets, too, have recently begun to speculate a lot on the issue of muse. The muse is, you know, the poet's inspiration. I really feel something. Have other people been rotating? Like, maybe, you know, if I were on a sort of carousel. I feel very bad. I'm sorry. The poet's inspiration has traditionally been metaphorized, because the poet was male, as a beautiful, seductive woman, right? The muse. So what happens when the poet is a woman? What kind of muse does the woman poet have? And if she does have a muse, what is sex? I think that Dickinson answers that poem in several ways, in the poems that I've read you, and I find that I myself have inexorably and inevitably also answered the question in several ways. The first way is the way that we saw in I Have a King Who Does Not Speak. This is a poem called The Return of the Muse. You always knew who wrote for him. You said, he is the father of my art, the one who watches all night, chain smoking, never smiling, never satisfied. You liked him because he was carved glaciers, because you had to give him strong wine to make him human, because he flushed once like a November sunset when you pleased him. But you didn't love him. You thought that was part of bargain. He'd always be there like a blood relic, a taciturn uncle or cousin if you didn't love him. You'd hand poems, he'd inspect them, smoke, sip, a business deal, and that would be that. Then he went away, and you hardly noticed, except you were happy. You danced on the lawn, swelled like a melon, lay naked long mornings, brushed your hair more than you needed. Your breast grew pink and silky. You hummed, you sucked the pulp of oranges. You forgot all about words. And when you were absolutely ignorant, he came back. His jacket of ice flashed white light. His cap of pallor bent toward you, genteel, unsmiling. He lit a cigarette, crossed his legs, told you how clumsy you were. Ah, then love seized you like a cramp. You doubled over in the twist of love. You shrieked. You gave birth to enormous poems. He looked embarrassed and said how bad they were. They became beasts. They grew fangs and beards. You sent them against him like an army. He said they were all right, but added that he found you, personally, unattractive. You howled with love. You spun like a dervish with rage. You kept on writing. The second poem I'll read gives an alternative answer to that question about the muse that the female poet has, and it's called For the Muses. They said I couldn't find you. They said because I'm a she, because the F my name blurs my features, a hiss around my face like unclear, you would be interested. They said my breasts would hinder me, heavy, hard to carry, with nipples like blinded eyes. They said the inflatable rubber cell in my belly would frighten, and the lips between my legs, you'd expect me to eat you up. But I remember you too well. You were the immigrant aunts I visited in the suburbs of my childhood, keeping house with what you'd salvaged on the long flight from Paris. Diamonds in the lining of your coat, embroideries from the 1890s, Egyptian jewelry, a samovar, old cashmere scarves, a rosewood wardrobe larger than the bathroom. Aunt Rose, your hair was black. It grew in wings from your forehead. Aunt Lil, your hair was white. It circled your skull like a shawl. You see, I remember. And your fourth floor flat, where I visited you, where you fed me oranges, honey, cakes, and wine. I remember that, too. The prints of the lovers in the forest, the witch pictures on the wall, the plants that hummed in the dark, the black feet of the cock. You spoke to me there. You told me the story. I was yours as much as any boy, or more, for the notion of my breasts yours. You planned them. You designed them. And the afternoon you led into the rosewood wardrobe and opened the great carved door. You smiled when I myself pulled out center oar. Smiled when all that light came spilling out and wrapped itself around my arms, my thighs, my shoulders, like a bolt of old satin. A mantle, not a shroud, you said. Thank you. I do try to be upbeat in response to my mother's sort of plaint that, why does she write poetry that's so morbid? She had such a happy childhood. The last two poems that I'll read will be poems that really were very consciously written as tributes to Emily Dickinson. And again, one of them is darker than the other, I think reflecting my own changed sense of Dickinson. The first one that I'll read you is the title poem of my book, and it's called Emily's Bread. And it was written at the time that Susan Gobar and I were working on The Madwoman in the Attic, and when I thought a lot about Dickinson as being really trapped and imprisoned in her house and in domesticity, as you'll see from the second and last poem that I'll read about Dickinson, I changed my mind, and I decided that, as Adrienne Rich has put it, she decided to have it out on her own premise in a very powerful way. The first poem, Emily's Bread, had two epigraphs. The first, 1857, from a chronology of Dickens' life. 1857, Emily's Bread won a prize at the annual cattle show. I might note that her sister was one of the judges, but her bread really was supposed to be very good. 1858, it was rye bread, in case you're interested. 1858, Emily served as a judge in the bread division of the cattle show, and maybe Lavinia won a prize that year. Inside the prize-winning blue ribbon loaf bread, there is Emily, dressed white, veiled in unspeakable words, not yet writing letters to the world. No, now she is the bride of yeast, the wife of the dark of the oven, the alka-flower, poetess of butter, stirring like a metaphor in every bubble as the loaf begins to grow. Prosaic magic, how it swells, like life, expanding, browning at the edges, hardened. Emily picks up her pen, begins to scribble. Who'll ever know? This is my letter to the world that never. Lavinia cracks an egg, polishes the rise walls light. Across the hall, the judges are making notes. Firmness, texture, size, flavor. Emily scribbles, smiles. She knows it is white aroma of her baked skin that makes the bread taste good. Outside in the cattle pen, the blue ribbon heifers bellow and squeal. Bread means nothing to them. They want to lie in the egg-yellow sun. They are tired of dry grain, tired of grooming and love. They long to eat the green old meadow where they used to live. I think I thank you. As you can see, I think I really did see Dickinson as being trapped in domesticity and longing to eat the green old meadow where he used to live, like the mystic green that she writes about in the poem about the different dawn. But the last poem that I read, like, as I said, my changing sense of her, of course, the wonderful thing about her is that she is so compelling, so various, that one's sense of her is, in fact, continually changing. This is a poem about Emily Dickinson's black cake. Some of you may know that Emily Dickinson was very famous for baking black cake. And some of you may indeed know that you can find the recipe for her black cake in her letters. And indeed, there's also a little book called Emily Dickinson Cook and Poet, which gives all her recipes in case you're interested in trying others. I myself decided at a certain point, as one of my many tribute her, which take lots of different forms, to try to bake her black cake. So I looked up the recipe in the letters. I was a little bit daunted when it began, take a milk pail. Wasn't a little daunted. So I quartered it. I quartered the recipe. And I made a lot of black cake, which I served to a graduate seminar in feminist criticism that I was teaching. And then I put away the rest of black cake in my freezer, and I served it to five more seminars over the years. But you could try it. Maybe you should tempt it. I mean, it's very good. It has a lot of whole bottle of brandy in it, even when you quarter it. Probably wouldn't have to put it in the freezer. This last poem that I'm going to read is called The Emily Dickinson Black Cake Walk. And it has two epigraphs, both from Dickens' letters and each intended to claim one or another strange aspect of Hoem. In 1866, Dickinson wrote to somebody about her nephew, the very nephew Ned, in whose pocket she was putting raisins and cracked nuts, and writing for whom she was writing these little wonderful emblems and mottos. And she obviously had made quite an influence on him, an effect on him, because she said, Ned inherits Uncle Emily's ardor, lie. My flowers are near and foreign, and I have but to cross floor to stand by his aisle. Notice that she calls herself Uncle Emily. I mean, the fluidity of her identity is part of her magic, part of the way in which she mythologized herself. She signed herself Brother Emily sometimes, Uncle Emily Dickinson, and then also she was Emily, E-M-I-L-I-E sometimes, when she wanted to be particularly flirtatious and feminine, and then just plain old E-M-I-L-Y at other times. My second epigraph, a letter written in 1883, your sweet beneficence of bulb, I return as flower with a bit of this swarthy cake baked only in Domingo. But of course, notice that she is one who completes the metamorphosis of the bulbs into flowers. She is a kind of goddess. And Domingo, where this swarthy cake is baked, is really her own kitchen. So this is the Emily Dickinson black cake walk. Black cake, black night cake, black thick cake, out of which Emily leaped in bubbles of bitter sweetness, lucid or dark balloons of Emily, Emily, Uncle Emily, Dickinson, nobody, black Emily Dickin cake. How does your sugar grow? What is the garden? Where is furrow? Whose are the pods of heat and shadow? How did black bulbs dissolve their iron, leaves their silence, bees their drone of sunset honey into the oven that cooked you firm? Black cake, black Uncle Emily cake, I tunnel among your grand darkness, fierce as a mouse. Your riches are all my purpose. Your currents and death's eye raises wrinkling and thickening blackness, and the single almond light she buried somewhere under layers of shadow. One day, I too will be Uncle Sandra, iambic and terse. I'll hobble the tough sidewalk, the alleys that moan, go on, go on. Oh, when I reach those late night streets, when acorns and twigs litter my path like sentences the oaks no longer choose, say, I want that cake in my wallet. I want to nibble as I hobble. I want to smile and nibble that infinite black cake and lean on Uncle Emily's salt white, ice bright sugar cane. Thank you.